Just a heads up before we begin, this episode includes some discussion of suicide. Please take care while listening.
My son's 19 now, but for many years we would go to all the superhero movies, and you go and you go for the noise of it and the bombast, and it's an assault. It's essentially like you're being beaten over the head. But the universe is in peril, and you can't feel anything. You're witnessing a spectacle. There's no part of me that is the universe going to make it, you know? But a church jumble sale, it's like, well, is the priest going to flirt back a little bit? Maybe he'll just touch her hand, you know? And that's approachable, and that's feels truer and better.
In Patrick DeWitt's latest novel, The Librarianist, the stakes couldn't be lower. DeWitt, as a reminder, wrote the darkly funny Western, The Sisters Brothers. It was shortlisted for the Booker Prize a few years back. It's a personal favourite. Titular brothers Eli and Charles bicker their way across its pages, and as long as you're not too squeamish about horse welfare, it's an extremely lovable book. And it's the kind of book that makes you follow its author anywhere. Which is lucky in the case of Patrick DeWitt, because following him anywhere is going to lead you to some weird and wonderful places. Under Major Domo Minor, his third book was a kind of Princess Bride-esque bit of fabulism. His fourth, French Exit, was a comedy of manners with a haunted cat and some severely unsympathetic down-at-heel aristocrats. It was made into a film with Michelle Pfeiffer. You never know what you're going to get with a Patrick DeWitt book. But now, with book five, what you get is Bob Comet, retired librarian, introvert, committed to a quiet life. The stakes couldn't be lower. And that's how Patrick DeWitt likes it. I'm Michael Williams, and this is Read This, a show about the books we love and the introverts behind them.
I'm hearing from some readers that the character of Bob is sad, and he experiences sadness, but I don't think of him, or again, his life choices as being particularly, I think if you asked Bob, you know, how he thought of his life, I think he was doing all the things that he wanted to do, and perhaps romance didn't necessarily work out for him and friendship was complicated, but in terms of his own choices and the way he chose to pass his time, I think he thinks of himself as fortunate and that he found his vocation at a young age and that the vocation delivered on its promise.
How much do you think that reading of Bob as sad is about how we as a culture, as a society, regard the elderly or people later in their life? Bob is 71. He's a retired librarian.
Yeah.
One of the kind of big sets of ideas in the book, that thing about old people and old age,
right,
and how we regard them. Do you think the inclination is to say Bob's sad because Bob is at the stage of his life where we think about either regrets or redemption?
I think that that's part of it. And one of the impetuses for the book was that I was helping out at a senior center. And so I came to think of seniors and the way seniors are represented and thought of, certainly in North America, but I'm sure it's a global phenomenon, as being incorrect. So I was addressing that in a sense. I think the people that do think of Bob as being a sad character think of him as sad because he is alone. I'm doing air quotes. And there is something to that, I suppose. Again, forced exile is different than choosing to be alone. But the people who choose to be alone, and I'm at least partly one of these people, there's nothing sad about it. When people go against their nature, that's when true sort of pathos and sadness comes in. I do have friends. I mean, I'm not isolated to the point of it being problematic. I understand the impulse to spend time alone and to do one's work in solitude. You know, I don't sit down to work with a heavy heart every day. I sit down to work enthusiastic and keen.
What did you find when you went to do the reading in the old age home and spend some time with the residents there?
Yeah.
Was it surprising to you? Did it change your kind of your own way of understanding elderly people in your life, elderly people around you? Were you aware of gaps in your assumptions from before then?
Well, the impetus for me doing this was I was speaking to my ex-wife and she was saying, you write full-time and you do have more time than most people have. And wouldn't it be nice to turn that back and do something for the community? And I left the house feeling insulted because I thought that working dutifully on my books was community service enough. But then I sat with it. And because she'd said it in a kind of lovely way, she wasn't being vicious about it. And I thought, oh, she's right. I could be doing something more. And right around that same time, about a week later, a friend of a friend who became my friend asked me if I ever wanted to come by a senior center, which was just up the road from my house. She was the director. It's since shuttered. COVID shut it down. But pre-COVID, she said, do you want to come read to them once or twice or weekly or monthly? And I thought, yeah, I'll come in once a week. So I started coming in, not knowing what to expect. But I came to find a as you would imagine, a various group of people, some of whom were hugely inspirational and humorous and lovely, and some who were, like, you know, quite unhappy, complicated to be around. The whole world was represented, basically, in this small group of people. And some were really keen to hear me read. I don't think anyone there knew who I was or was familiar with my work, but some of them anyway became acquainted with the work, and we established a bond. It was a various experience whereby sometimes I would be met with total indifference and silence, and sometimes I would be met with, you know, genuine gratitude and teary eyes and things like that, depending on the mood of the day, what was going on in their lives, what I was reading to them. It became very stressful what to select, because it was just an hour's reading and then we would chat. But it's hard to find something, I found, because I wanted to go in without anything that was too complicated, especially in terms of vulgarity. Obviously, I was keen to avoid any references to death. And I realized that almost everything that I read is filled with vulgarity and death. Everything that I have access to that I wanted to share. And it was, so I would pre-read texts and no, I can't read that. God damn it. There's death in that. There's references to sex in this. And they were an evolved group and that they were game for more or less whatever. But my job there was to present them with a sort of an uplift. I didn't want to depress them. So there's a scene in this book where the protagonist, Bob, reads an Edgar Allan Poe story called The Black Cat. And that happened. That was one of the first readings. It was right around Halloween. I did not pre-read the text because I knew, you know, it's Poe. There's not going to be any sex or vulgarity. Might be a little bit macabre, but they can handle it. But yeah, the cat in question is like mutilated and hung from a tree. And this very sweet woman whose name I can't remember raised her hand sort of shyly, and she just asked me to stop reading. I'm not enjoying this. Can we please read something else or just talk? So that made it into the book. But I came to really enjoy spending time with them as people, and the whole idea that I would be reading to them fell by the wayside fairly quickly. And I would read to them, but as often as not, they just wanted to chat. They just wanted to gossip, especially if I had come from somewhere because I travel a lot. And I remember coming back from Dublin. And I was going to read something, and they just sort of waved the book away, like, how was Dublin? What was Dublin like? And I said, Dublin's great. I love Ireland. It's one of my favorite places on earth. What was the food like? And I said, well, I ate the worst Mexican food of my life in Dublin. And they loved that. They wanted information from beyond. And I was only too happy to share it with them when I had access to it. So I did feel a great tenderness for the most part for these men and women, and I felt... came to think of the book as a bit of a hat doff to them.
Can I just ask, for the most part there, as a writer, are you as interested in the ones you don't feel great tenderness for? Like, was yeah. it useful as well for the ones where you're yeah. like, oh no, that's a cantankerous old?
Cantankerous people are generally much more interesting to me. People with conflict, as a writer, they're less pleasant to spend time with. But I do endure in the name of material. I want to say, I went into the situation with helping out at the senior center with virtually no hopes of getting in material. Like, I do things just to do them. But as soon as I got in there, I thought, well, I'm going to be using this. There's yeah. no way I can't. But my impulse was pure at the outset. I was corrupted almost at once. But
for the first time, arguably, I mean, you have a number of characters throughout your body of work who could be described as introverts. But mm-hmm. Bob Comet, for the first time, you have built a book around someone who is personally quite deliberately recessive in yeah. many ways.
Yeah, card-carrying introvert.
Are you an introvert?
Well, at the outset of the book, I would have said unequivocally yes. And I think that I skew that way. To me, the definition of introvert versus extrovert, Bill Clinton is a classic extrovert in that at the end of an event, he would come off stage and he would be energized.
Yeah.
And Al Gore was the opposite. and that he would come off an event that went really well and everyone would be cheering his name and he would be terribly fatigued. And I think I skew more gore. So at the outset of the book, I thought I'm going to represent my ilk in this character of Bob Comet. I'm realizing in discussing the book that it's a bit more complicated for me. I'm not any one particular thing. And I think few people actually are any one particular thing.
No, it is. It's like star signs or Myers-Briggs or any of those things where people go, oh, well, I'm this, but with a bit of that. Or in this context, I do this. And then, this moon rising is essential for understanding me.
Exactly. Yeah. But I think I identify more wholly with the introvert, and I'm sympathetic to Bob's decisions. And a lot of his lifestyle choices make sense to me.
Is the novel uniquely well-placed as an art form to tell the story of introverts?
I think novel writing is the natural playground or habitat of the introvert. I think most introverts, it's not that we have a disdain or dislike for humanity. It's just that humanity fatigues us or makes us uncomfortable, and we're more naturally at ease keeping company with ourselves. But I do have an affinity for and a love for people and humanity, and I'm curious about them endlessly. And I think that that's reflected in the work. So for me, it feels I'm at a healthy remove as opposed to like an unhealthy remove. Like I am alone most of the time, but I am thinking about people. So it's like socializing.
It is a thread that runs through all of your books, I think, about that nature of community and about the interaction between people. Sisters, brothers, if I understand right, began with an exercise where you're writing dialogue between two characters.
Yeah.
And it was the moment at which one of the characters got their feelings hurt that those characters came to life, that they were similar, and then an emotional disconnection was where story came from for you.
Yeah. I think throughout each of the books that there is an example of relationships going poorly and then coming back together. The study of humanity, I think, is the through line for all the books. I've been told that all my books are different, and I think that that's true, but I think it's sort of surface differences. You know, the stage setting is different. The costume is different. But really, it's all about how we relate to one another, what we desire from one another, why we don't get what we need oftentimes in human relationships, and just sort of the folly of mankind, right?
And it seems to me that you write about that with a great deal of affection, but also with a great deal of amusement. I mean, human folly is inherently funny.
It is to me. I think some people approach it as a tragedy or our inability to connect or the difficulties in our connections being a tragic thing. But I've always seen human behaviors through the lens of comedy. And this is probably stemming from family behaviors and growing up with two, you know, fairly funny parents who were quick to point things out as being ridiculous rather than tragic. I don't think it's wrong to look at it as tragic. I think tragedy's there if you want it. It's not going anywhere, right? But I prefer to see it this other way.
Coming up after the break, death, divorce, and decency. More Patrick DeWitt in just a minute.
Did you know you can support the artists you love and receive a tax deduction for donations over $2 through the Australian Cultural Fund? Last year, the Australian Cultural Fund facilitated over $11 million of donations to artists across the country. You can make a real difference to the work of Australian artists this end of financial year by donating through the Australian Cultural Fund. For more information, visit australianculturalfund.org.au.
As a 7am listener, you value the story behind the headlines. That's why you should read Post, a free daily newsletter bringing you the top 5 news stories of the day, summarising each of their key points. Sign up today at thesaturdaypaper.com.au/newsletters.
There's this quote I love from a Paul Auster book, I can't remember which one, where his 80-something-year-old protagonist is asked what it feels like to be old. He pauses for a moment and then replies, "What a strange thing to happen to a little boy." None of us are strangers to the idea that we feel this disconnect between our actual age and how we see ourselves. For Patrick DeWitt, that disconnect informs the way he writes and informed in no small way his latest novel.
I've been really relieved, and thinking of the people that I worked with at the senior center, and I read to them, you know. And I remember one day asking them, like, how old do we feel, you know, in our minds? Because I feel, in my mind, I feel 30 is sort of the number I come up with. I'm 48 now. And we're looking out at people who are between 60 and 85. And everybody agreed. Most people thought in their mind, you know, you think you don't really age in your mind if things are going to plan, unless you begin to sort of atrophy emotionally, I think. So that's a nice thing to think of for me.
How does that fit with your sense of your own growth creatively as a writer? Like, you're a very different writer now to the writer you were when you were 30. Does that feel like aging?
It doesn't feel like aging, but I'm aware of a passage of time, and I'm aware of a shift in interest. You know, if you look at pictures of yourself as a child, you know it's you. It's you, but it's not really you. So I look at my first book, and I see somebody making page by page, line by line, different choices than I would make now. So I can't really relate to the book, which isn't to say I'm not proud of it, because I am. But I see that book as somebody with just a completely separate aesthetic than my own aesthetic that I am involved with now. Understanding also that if I'm lucky enough to continue to be able to create work, I'm sure at some point, I hope at some point I look back at this book and feel the same about it. You know?
Is there some element of conscious reaction to previous work when you write a new work?
Not so much in the way of regret, but yes, I absolutely, with this book perhaps more clearly than the others, the sense of wanting to write a different manner of book, a book that was a little bit less fantastical, a book that was a little bit less fireworks, fewer bangs, something that was a bit more placid. As a reader, I think I want less from my authors than I used to want. I'm much more comfortable with unanswered questions and vague things, you know, general feeling as opposed to a specific pinpointed bullseye emotion. Yeah, just generally wanting less as a reader and sort of offering less as a writer. Again, I think maybe less is not the wisest word to use. I don't mean that I want the reader to feel cheated or frustrated, but I think it's just becoming more specialized in my mind. You know, I think Sisters Brothers was written, it just came out naturally, but I think that checks a lot of boxes, you know. I have a suspicion that my books going forward will check fewer boxes.
Part of that is allowing space as well, allowing them
space
to...
Space and silence, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, an emptier room, you know. There's as much to see in a sparse room to me now than there is with like a very cluttered, busy room.
There's a great quote from you in an interview you gave for the New York Times where you said, I wish authors would write less about the innate nobility of the indomitable human spirit and more about failure without redemption, or the murky zone in between failure and getting by, where many of us live in real life.
Yeah. I don't need to be reminded of man's potential for heroism, which isn't to say there's not small moments of nobility or grace that are moving to me as a reader or as a writer. But I just wish we could turn the volume down a bit, you know.
The book's dedicated to your memory of your friend David Berman,
yeah,
who last time you were here, in fact, was August 2019. It was just after he'd died.
Right.
And you just started writing this book, but he was very much on your mind,
yeah,
during that period. Mm-hmm. And that sense of loss and influence and friendship, I think, does palpably run through it.
Yeah. Before I was friends with David, I was a fan of David's. He's a poet and a songwriter. And he was one of the very rare people who was more or less my age, he was a bit older, who I could relate to. Since I've begun reading, I tend to read people who are no longer with us. And it was meaningful to me to have access to, there are people out there doing it, and doing it well, and I can relate. And he was sort of an aspirational figure to me in a sense. And then I came to know him as a man and found him to just be a terrifically entertaining, sympathetic, lovely, strange human being. Somebody like David dies, there's a David-shaped hole that can't be filled. When somebody you love goes away, there's a sense of loss and it just takes, nothing can fix it but time. But the time it took to fix that feeling was the same time as me working on this book. So I think that his presence is there in subtle ways. And then just sort of that sense of life being sort of drudge work, I think that was partly because of his death and the way he died. You know, he committed suicide. So he's in there, and it seemed just to dedicate the book to him.
But death is kind of omnipresent in your work.
Yeah, I'm aware of the clock ticking, and I think I have been since I was a child. I'm not one who relishes arguments with loved ones because I've always thought, since a young age, I've always thought, well, if you part on bad terms with somebody, knowing you're going to make up, they might die. Like that, I don't know why that was in my mind as a child, but it was. So I think it's a good thing to think of, honestly, because I think there's a tendency, if you feel that way, if you're aware of death, and if you live with death, there's a tendency to treat people a little bit more decently and fairly, which is not to say that I'm thoroughly decent and fair, because I'm not, but I'm aware of it. So if I'm arguing with somebody, I want to put the argument to bed because one of us might get hit by a bus. And then what?
It might be a morbid starting point for care, but it's a good basis for it.
Whatever gets you there, right?
Yeah, that's right. It's the end result. If you care, then that's a good thing.
If my empathy is stemming from paranoia, then so be it.
Part of the reason I wanted to ask about David is that one of the things I like in The Librarianist, and it comes back again, I think, to the question of having an introvert as your main character, is that thing of how hard it is to make friends at any stage of your life.
Yeah.
But particularly the further it goes on, the more set in your ways you get, the more kind of you take comfort in certain rhythms of your life. And that even in a quiet, introspective book, letting someone new into your life is a rupture. It's a major kind of hinge on which to hang a story.
Well, I think of the time, you know, my wife and I split up. We were married for 10 years and together for, I think, 15. And we split up and I found myself friendless. I was 37, 38. I mean, I had friends elsewhere, but in our town where we lived, I suddenly didn't really have access to a friend group. And so I remember thinking that that was fine. And then time passed and it became less fine. Around the age of 40, I thought, oh my God, I have to go out and make friends. So I made friends, but it was, I mean, it was an odd thing and sort of not humiliating, but a little bit, you know, I'm 40, I got to go make friends, my God. And I made friends and they're wonderful and I love them and they're there for me in Portland. So it worked out, but I was thinking of that time when I was writing this book, because how does an introvert make friends? How does a non-gregarious person, where do you go and what do you do? And so Bob goes without for most of his life, but there's a couple of scenes in the book or a couple of eras in the book where he has found people who like him for him. And that's something that I hope I'm not hitting the reader over the head with what a relief that must be for Bob, but I'm empathetic with him and I feel joy for him when he finds people who clearly like him because he's Bob.
When you're done with a book, what happens to the mental and emotional space that you've created for a character? Will Bob be hanging around with you for years to come?
He's gone now. There's a phase after the completion of the book, and a book is finished so many times, but when the first draft is done and you know it's done and you look at it and you take some time, let other people read it, there's this phase where you're not writing, but the characters are still present and you're still wondering, and oftentimes you're making amendments to the book. So you're still ultimately working on it, and then you return to it in rewrites. But when the book's done, when the copy edits are done, and you send it away and there's nothing more that you can do because it's been wrenched from your hands, for me, there's a phase where I become, each time, confused and deeply peevish. And you would think that once you're finally done, you would be able to sit around and pat yourself on the back or have a swim or something, you know? And that moment has just never really been there for me. It's confusion, annoyance, and hostility. So typically, I will busy myself with something that's physical, you know, like working on the house or something. But really, life doesn't make sense to me unless I'm working on something. If I don't have something to sort of lose myself in every day, then some part of me believes that I'm wasting my time, which it isn't really true. Because you have to live, and I enjoy living, but I prefer strongly life where I've sort of got half a foot in that world, the real world, and then half a foot in the make-believe world.
P- Patrick DeWitt's latest novel, The Librarianist, is out now.
As a 7am listener, you value the story behind the headlines. That's why you should read Post, a free daily newsletter bringing you the top five news stories of the day, summarising each of their key points with links to full articles from a range of sources. Get the news you need to your inbox every weekday morning with Post. Sign up at thesaturdaypaper.com.au/newsletters.
Before we go, I wanted to tell you what I've been reading this week, and it's a magnificent work of non-fiction. It's called Deep Water, The World in the Ocean, and it's by local writer James Bradley. It's this incredible, sweeping study of our relationship with the ocean, the things we don't know about it, and the surprises and mysteries that can be found in its depths. It's well worth a read. You can find Deep Water and all of Patrick DeWitt's backlist at your favourite independent bookstore. Special shout out once again to the Sisters Brothers. It's crazy fun. That's it for this week's show. As ever, rate, review and share. It helps a lot. Next week on Read This, I chat with an Australian institution, someone who's been putting together stories for almost half a century now. It's the singular Maurice Gleitzman.
Stories have a capacity to deal in possibilities. And what I think young readers deserve is that they not be only the best possibilities, because I think we all, and kids today still, become aware that our lives are participating in a dance between the worst possibilities and the best possibilities and everything that lies between.
Read This is produced and edited by Clara Ames. Mixing and original compositions are by Zoltan Fetcher. Thanks for listening. See you next week.